Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
If you had any questions about how last night's Patriots-Jets game would go, those questions were answered on the very first drive. I mean, you shouldn't have had any questions, but maybe you were trying really, really hard. Maybe you were dumb enough to convince yourself that the alleged mastermind, Adam Gase, would have something brilliant or something special that he could dial up for Monday night. He didn't. Or maybe you were foolish enough to think that the Jets had found something against the Cowboys. They didn't. Because the Patriots took that opening kickoff, and then they went on a 16-play, 9-minute, soul-snatching opening drive that was capped off by Sony Michel going in from 3 yards out.
Brady under center, third down and two, gets the snap. He pitches out. It goes to Michel. Got a block at the 5. He runs into the end zone. Touchdown over the left tackle. With blockers ahead, 3-yard touchdown run.
Thanks to WWO, Westwood One. Touchdown. Ball game. Thanks for coming. Man, that game was over before the Jets even touched the ball. And when they did get the ball, it really was over. Because on the second play, this happened.
Here comes Collins on a blitz. Darnold quickly unloads, and he throws an interception right into the hands of Devin McCourty, who zigzags across the 15-yard line and is dropped at the 12. The Patriots went after Darnold, and McCourty has another pick, his fifth of 2019.
Patriots radio on the call. Somehow the Jets defense held the pass to a field goal. And if you really, really wanted to work way too hard, you might have been able to convince yourself that the Jets still had a chance. But they didn't. And they proved it by going 3 and out. Then giving up a touchdown to fall behind 17-0. Then Sam Darnold was strip sacked, giving up another touchdown and chucking an INT. I mean, it's not that the Jets were bad. They were that. They were bad. But they were worse than bad. We've come to expect bad. But I at least expected them to compete. I at least expected the Jets to show up. But they didn't. And that's not just me questioning their professionalism. Well, actually, that is me questioning their professionalism. How the hell did that team not show up? How the hell does that team not show up on that stage in prime time, at home, against the defending world champs and a rival who has dominated them in recent years and when they were coming off a nice win? I'm asking how the hell that can happen. I am asking that, but I'm not the only one. They're also asking themselves that. At least one of them is defensive captain Jamal Adams. He called it, quote, an embarrassing effort. He said the Jets, quote, didn't come to play, end quote. Pretty much, Jay. The question isn't whether or not they came to play, because they didn't. The question is, why didn't they come to play? And how the hell can that happen? At one point in the first half, the Patriots had 24 points and the Jets had 20 yards. New England had more first downs than the Jets had plays. Like, these are mind-boggling stats. But even the numbers do not do that game justice. It was so much worse than that 33-0 beatdown would suggest. The game wasn't nearly that close. What an utter waste of time that was. So no, we didn't learn anything that we didn't already know about the Patriots. Tom Brady could have pulled 10 randos out of the stands and still beaten the Jets last night. So the Pats are who we thought they were. But so are the Jets. Only worse. Much worse. But I do have one question. I've got one question about the Jets, and I have to ask this question. And I'm not here to go all shock jock. I'm not here to go all hot take on anybody. This is a serious, legitimate question. Did the Jets flat out quit last night? Because getting cracked 33-0 in prime time and coughing up 6 turnovers sure seemed a hell of a lot like quitting. I'm not saying they did. I'm posing a question. I'm not saying that they did quit. I want to be clear about that. Don't get it twisted. I'm not saying they did quit. I'm saying that that's what it would look like if they quit. Horrible offense, a quarterback taking a beating, a defense that featured missed tackles and DBs jogging after receivers, and a moment like this.
Gets in the gun from their 6, second down and 7. High snap into the end zone through the hands of Darnold. He kicks it out of the back of the end zone, and a flag.
Well, the flag's going to be for illegal batting, but you don't really care at that point. It's a safety either way. Get the ball out of the end zone. Wow.
Defensive lineman Leonard Williams said afterwards, quote, "It's bad to just give up. I definitely don't see that in anybody on this team," end quote. All right, something we've covered a number of times on this show over the years. Quitting is the worst thing that you can do in sports. Literally. Tell me something worse than quitting in sports. So I'm always very, very careful before I allege or suggest that somebody quit. Honestly, I hope that they did. I really hope the Jets did quit. Because if that was them trying, that's even worse. And yes, I am aware that Sam Darnold had a truly horrible game. I mean, a truly, truly wretched game. One of the worst games you'll ever see. 11 of 32, 86 yards, 4 INTs and a fumble, and a passer rating of 3.6. I said 3.6. I mean, like 3.6 is a pretty good GPA, but 3.6 is an absolutely horrible passer rating. The only thing missing from that was a butt fumble. But the one thing that he did do is give the world a useful, mic'd up segment for the first time ever. Because that also normally is a big waste of time. Normally the guy who's wearing the mic is walking around yelling mindless stuff like, "Let's go! Let's play hard! It's a great day to play football!" Except Darnold finally gave us something useful. Finally took us to a very dark place when he said this.
"Seeing ghosts.
I'm seeing ghosts.
Seeing ghosts."
That's good. That's good. Almost as good as "I see dead people."
I see dead people.
Kind of dark, you know, on so many levels. And when Patriots linebacker Kyle Van Noy heard that, he loved it.
He said at one point on the ESPN broadcast that felt like he was seeing ghosts out
there. Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's the boogeyman. It's real.
You talk about the continuity of your defense where up front you guys are putting
pressure. Sorry. He really said that?
Yeah. Well, how were you guys able to rattle him for
that's,
him to see
ghosts? That's crazy for him to say that. It is. That makes it real, you know what I'm saying? That's crazy.
What's that mean to you that he's seeing ghosts?
I mean, I can't believe he said that.
Man, my man loved that. My man loved that. Kyle Van Noy couldn't get enough of that. The only thing missing from that was, "Hey, play it for me." He said that? He really said that? Like 4 times he said that? So, this guy's seeing ghosts. Is the Patriots defense that good or are the Jets just that bad? I mean, yes, I guess. But it's more of a case of the Jets being that bad. The Pats defense is playing well. I mean, don't confuse that. I just need to see that so-called domination defensively against a team or teams that matter and actually care, because the Jets right now don't satisfy that criteria. As for Darnold, he might not look like Kenny Stabler in his prime against Dallas last week, but he looked like any other young quarterback going up against the hood last night, completely confused, rattled, and turned inside out. He's not the first, he's not going to be the last, but it's not all his fault. Crazy Eyes has to wear a chunk of that. That's also on the head coach, because clearly there were a number of Jets that were not prepared to play that game last night. Not even close. They weren't prepared for the Pats defense. They weren't prepared for the Pats offense. They weren't prepared to play football. That's on the alleged offensive mastermind with the crazy eyes. The guy who just got shut out. The offensive genius who has them dead last in yards per game. Tied for last in points per game. They're tied with the Dolphins for fewest points. And the Dolphins aren't even trying. I'm talking about Adam Gase. 6 games into his time as Jets head coach. And I think it's fair to ask how many more games this team can take with him as the head coach. Look, as always, I'm not looking to get anybody fired. Ever. But this team is worse, not better, since he took over. And Sam Darnold, their franchise quarterback, is seeing ghosts.
Seeing ghosts.
I've seen enough from Sam Darnold to know that there is something there. I've seen enough to think that this guy can be a franchise quarterback. But I've seen nothing from Gase to let me know that he should coach the franchise. And the events of last night and of this season with Gase, if they're going to stick with Darnold. And they might. It's enough to make you wonder whether or not the team is risking long-term damage to the psyche of Darnold by continuing this. Gaze had this to say for himself afterwards.
Obviously, that was brutal. We didn't do anything right. All three phases, we were bad. It was just bad performance.
Correction. All four phases were bad. Offense, defense, special teams, and coaching. Because Bill Belichick fitted you and yours for the world's largest clown suit ever. Gase actually had the nerve to say this.
I didn't expect that at all.
That's the problem. You didn't. You're about the only one. Just about everybody else did. You did trail New England 20-0 in the second quarter earlier this season. I'm surprised they didn't hang 50 on you. Remember, this is the same guy who was saying in July, quote, we're going to play meaningful games in the end of November and December.
We're going to play meaningful games in the end of November and December. That's what we're going to do.
I mean, that felt utterly ridiculous back in July when he said it, and it seems insane in October. If by meaningful games you mean coaching for your job, then yeah, that's pretty accurate. But there's nothing meaningful about what the Jets did last night or what they've done this year. The only thing you can take away from last night's game is that it made Dallas losing to these jokers look even worse. And finally, how bad are the Jets? New England just beat them down 33-0 and realized the offense still was not that good, so they went out and they added Mohamed Sanu this morning. Like, normally if you win a game like that, you think to yourself, hey, maybe we don't have to do anything. We're good. We just beat somebody 33-0. Oh, no, not the Pats. They're like, yeah, that doesn't mean anything. We got to make this move. We got to give up a high draft pick because we only beat the Jets. That didn't even happen. Does that even count? Do we even get a win for that? Vaughn Bell is my guest. It's great to have you on. Vaughn, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you, Vaughn. So if you were to go back to Sunday, let me start right there. You were going on the road against a team that came into the season with really high expectations. You knew you were playing without Drew Brees, Alvin Kamara, Jared Cook, among others. So what was the attitude and the mindset of you and the rest of the defense going into that matchup?
We knew it was going to be a heavyweight fight. We knew that both defense, which best defense go play, who's going to win the game and get the ball back to the quarterbacks and give them a great field position. And we stepped up to the challenge, and that's what we did.
All right, so then you come out on the first series, and you force a three and out, and the special teams blocks the punt, gets a safety. How important, how huge was it to start the game that way?
Man, it was huge. Just the field position and making – turnover and block field goal, explosive play on special teams on their side of the field, and got a safety. It built some momentum for us, and we started fast.
We're talking to Vaughn Bell of the Saints, and then later in the first quarter, you forced a fumble and you recovered it. Can you take me through the play? What did you see on that play, and how good did it feel to come up with the ball?
Man, I just seen the guy, the runner. I just seen the ball. I put my head on the ball, and I had like other guys on the defense swarming, flying, pursuing to the ball, and I just try to make a play on the ball because we have this little Saturday tape each week, and we just try to be on each week about takeaways, and we're just hunting for the ball and just trying to make an explosive play for the offense and set them up in field position to score.
Vaughn Bell, my guest, excuse me. You know, Vaughn, I was talking about in the open. That's your fourth fumble recovery this season. I mean, I would argue that if you do this one or two times, it might be a matter of being in the right place at the right time, but if you have four fumble recoveries in seven games, there's something more to that. That's a skill, it seems to me. What is your approach when it comes to finding the ball and getting it?
Oh, man, I'll just be – this is as a DB. We should always just challenge each other, just go hunt for the ball and just always just find the ball because it's all about the ball at the end of the day, and we just want to set up and make a explosive play on defense for the offense and set them up to score, and maybe we could score too like we did previous week. So we're just trying to always just go for the ball at the time.
We're talking Saints football. Vaughn Bell is my guest. You know, if we were to go back to training camp, your secondary coach, Aaron Glenn, made the point that last season was the best season of your career, but you're putting up even better numbers this season. So how different are you as a player now than when you first came into the NFL?
Very different. Just the knowledge of the game, growth and experience, going through ups and downs, and just learning the game and just really becoming a pro. And that's what I've been doing, just growing through the game and just growing each and every week, and just trying to play my best football towards the end of the year. But just starting fast, just really just learning each and week in and week out, just being around my guys and really just want to make a play for them.
It seems to me also that key phrase is becoming a pro, because you've spent a lot of time watching film, preparing the offseason. So when you put in all that work, does it really slow the game down the way guys say that it does? And you're able to impose, are you able to impose yourself on the game even more than in the past?
For sure. When situations come throughout the football game, You see formations, you see the down distance, and you know what you're getting. Just watching film in preparation throughout the week through practice, and just watching film by yourself and with your DB group, and it's just talking throughout the situation and knowing what you're getting. It just make you play that much faster.
Saints are 6-1. They've been 5-0 since Drew Brees went down. Von Bell is my guest. You know, Sunday, Chicago rushed for a total of 17 yards. That was one of the worst rushing performances in the history of their team. How much pride is there for you and the defensive unit to go out there and not just stop the run, but to dominate their run game to the point where they just quit trying?
Man, that's our mentality growing week in and week out. It's always to defend the run first, and we're going to make them pass it or play action, whatever they have to do to get the ball down the field. But stopping that first and we're just knowing the ball going in the air and just go attack it and make plays on the ball. So that's our really one of our goals is stopping the run. So we just got to make them play left-handed.
You know, it's even bigger than that, right? Like defensive tackle Sheldon Rankin said this, quote, "We take a backseat to nobody. We love our Hall of Fame quarterback. We love Teddy, we love Mike T, we love Alvin and all those guys, but at the end of the day, we're always going to put it on our shoulders," end quote. So how much pride is there, for instance, in the defense going on the road, putting the team on its shoulders, and dominating an opponent that had playoff aspirations? Do you want it on your shoulders?
For sure. We always stepping up for the challenge, like you said. Big Rank said that. We always love our guys, and we always trying to give them situations to make plays and get the ball back as much as possible, three and outs, takeaways, and set up great field position. But we just put it upon our shoulders, and we challenge everybody in the back end and that whole defensive unit, put on our shoulders, and let's go win this game, because they don't have to score. They don't have to run the ball. They don't have to do nothing. We could just take the ball away. We could score too. So, and that's what we said, and we just stepped up to the challenge, and that's what we did.
You know, Von, when Drew Brees went down, it seemed like this whole thing was on the outside looking in. The outside seemed to think that, wow, it's all on Teddy, when clearly the entire team stepped up, every phase, every unit, everybody in that locker room. But in terms of Teddy itself, it's like there's not just a lot of confidence for Teddy. There seems to be so much love and respect for Teddy Bridgewater. What's he like as a teammate, and how happy have you been with the way he has stepped up during this run?
Man, he's a phenomenal teammate. He comes talk to the defensive backs all the time. We call it deep block. He comes talk to us on the side of the locker room. We always joking with him. He's, like I said, he's a phenomenal teammate. He's a leader. Everybody listen to him. Everybody respect him. He did phenomenal things in this league, and he just keep on growing in this league. And we all got our trust in him, and we all got our faith, and we just try to play it much as harder. On defense to get them the ball back and get those guys rolling. So just keep on having this confidence, keep on growing each week in and week out. It's good for us, and that's how we just keep on playing with a swagger and that chip on our shoulder.
Von Bell joining me for a few more moments. Sean Payton has always been one of the best head coaches in football, but when you look at the job he's done this year, is he the coach of the year in your mind, and what's it been like to play for him?
Oh, for sure. He always in my eyes, he take care of us. We take care of him. Man, we go out there and play hard. And, man, he responds well. He challenges. He got that swagger, too, and that's what we love about him. And we just make it just play hard a little bit for each other and for him. And at the end of the day, we all in this together as a unit. And that's what we're in this for. Keep on getting a win each week and keep on growing as a team each week.
Yvonne, what's a swagger? What's swagger look like on a head coach? I mean, is it play calling? Is it the way he carries himself? What's it look like on a head coach?
He just got that look and demeanor. But, yeah, for sure how he carries himself. Play calling, talking, you know, talking a little mess to the team, talking mess to us, and just having that swagger, having that bounce in his step. And he know he's a man. And, you know, he got that big play sheep. He go dial up some, and that's what I'm talking about. I'm telling him when he cross something. Or if he tells us a shot play coming, he executes. He's not scared to pull the trigger. And that's what I'm talking about with the swagger.
I like that. Von Bell, my guest. Before you go, let's go back a little bit. You played your high school ball at Ridgeland High School near Chattanooga. What were you like as a player in high school?
Oh, man. I don't know how to explain it. I was all types of guy. I was all around. My mom just kept me in a lot of sports. I just wanted to be the best at everything I did. And I always just challenged myself. I had an older brother. And just always just playing up. And he always told me, I played up. And my age group, once I get to my age group, I'll just dominate. And he always had that mentality with my dad, too. He played college football. And he just always had that mentality of just dominating. He's just always just, it's not good enough. Nothing's ever good enough. It's always the next step to your game. So I just always had that mindset. And I just carried it with me throughout high school, college, and now here and the journey continues.
And look what it's done for you. Now when you go back in the summer and you host football camps at your high school, they also have an award named after you, the Von Bell Award. It's given out by the school to the best male and female athletes. What's it mean to have an award named after you at your school, and what was your reaction when you first heard about that?
Oh, man, it was a surreal moment. I was speechless. I'm very honored and humbled by that. And I said, man, I thought they was playing with me at first. And my mom told me, one of my high school coaches called me. I was like, man, it's a surreal moment. Speechless. I'm honored. And it's just really, man, I'm just really honored by it, man. It's just like, man, I left my legacy. And the legacy still continues, and I appreciate all those guys back home that's really just my supporting cast and always just looking out for me. And I just appreciate them from the bottom of my heart.
Yvonne, one last thought. I was in Madison, Wisconsin last week, and Wisconsin got beat by Illinois, so it took some of the luster off their showdown with Ohio State. As I mentioned, you won a national championship at Ohio State. You were an All-American there. Wisconsin's still coming in this weekend. What's it like when an opposing team comes into the Shoe? How intimidating is that house for opposing teams?
It is. It's going to be 100,000 people, 100,000 Buckeyes. It's going to be in that Shoe rocking. And, man, it's going to be an explosive, electric environment. And, man, it's very intimidating. I feel like it's the best stadium in college football. And we're going to have 100,000 Buckeye fans just screaming loud for us. And we're going to try to pick up another W.
Saints, 6-1 on the season. They're in first in the NFC South. Arizona is at New Orleans on Sunday. Once again, 1 p.m. Eastern on CBS. Von Bell on the program. Von, so good to have you on. I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you for doing that. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Let's get academic with it. Welcome to Sports Radio 101, hosted by me, Professor Van Smack. Today I'm going to teach all of you aspiring talk show hosts how to kill an entire segment, how to kill an hour, maybe even an entire program, if you're just too lazy to earn your paycheck and create original content. One of the most effective ways to do this is to throw out this question to your listening audience. Is fill in the blank a Hall of Famer? I repeat, is fill in the blank a Hall of Famer? That's it. Class dismissed. Just go sign yourself a contract, light up the phone lines, and chip me off my 10% whenever you get that chance. I'm telling you right now, I could do 3 hours just by showing up right before the program and asking out loud, is this thing on? Can you hear me? Pete Rose, should he be in the Hall of Fame? Eli Manning, Hall of Famer or nah? Or Barry Bonds, should he be in the Hall of Fame? Because all of that is sports radio super crack on a fishing line. It's also the lamest, laziest way to ever do a program, so I'm not going to do it. Never have, never will. Now, that being said, very likely today, you're going to get wall-to-wall, station-to-station, network-to-network debate on whether or not Steph Curry is a Hall of Famer. And I'm here to tell you that the only thing dumber than the Hall of Fame question in general is the is Steph Curry a Hall of Famer question in particular. But why is this an issue? Because the GOAT himself, the GOAT of get off my lawn, 45 himself, was the one who posed that question. In fact, he didn't even pose it in the form of a question. He said it as a fact. We're here because of 45. That's right. Michael Jordan seems to think that Steph Curry is not Hall of Fame material. At least that's what he seemed to suggest on the Today Show when he puked up this all-time terrible take.
Someone asked you if you could pick four guys for your pickup team, four guys that you play anybody else with. Hakeem Olajuwon, Magic Johnson, Scottie Pippen, and James Worthy. That was 6 years ago. Lots happened in the league in 6 years. Would you keep the same four?
In a heartbeat. When I'm going in the trenches, I played against and with all these guys. I'm going with who I know. Every single night, that responsibility to go out there and represent greatness every single night.
So Steph Curry shouldn't be offended when he watches this?
I hope not. He's still a great player. Not a Hall of Famer yet, though. He's not.
Let me run that back for a minute. Listen to it for a few things. Listen when you hear this. Listen to Mike question Steph's Hall of Fame worthiness literally for no reason at all. Like, Craig Melvin never asked if Steph Curry was a Hall of Famer. He just asked if Steph Curry should be offended that Mike did not pick him as one of his four running mates. But Mike just decides, hey, now would be a real good time to declare that Steph Curry is not a Hall of Famer. And then listen as Melvin laughs at the take, and Jordan sits there silently before doubling down with, well, he's not.
So Steph Curry shouldn't be offended when he watches this.
I hope not. Yeah, he's still a great player. Not a Hall of Famer yet, though. He's not.
I mean, the only thing missing there is, hey, Craig, I'm not joking. What are you laughing at? What's so funny here, man? He's not a Hall of Famer, Craig. He's just not.
He's not.
Hey, listen. I understand that Mike runs on a different sort of hate and a different sort of fuel than the rest of us. That's part of why he is the GOAT. I also get that, as I mentioned, he's become the GOAT of get off my lawn. But there's no way the guy means that, right? There is no way 45 believes that, right? There's no way Mike would ever say anything that dumb, right? Because Steph Curry is an all-time great. And as takes go, if Mike truly believes that, that's one of the all-time worst. Irv cannot believe the sort of verbal diarrhea that Mike is spewing right now. Again, there's no way Mike Jordan believes that. Absolutely, Steph is a Hall of Famer all day long. He's the best shooter ever, a three-time champ, a two-time MVP, somebody who changed the way the game is played. Like, I'm pissed that I had to even spend 10 seconds justifying why Steph Curry is a Hall of Famer. So there's no way Michael Jordan doesn't know that. There's no way Michael Jordan believes what he said. And if he doesn't, and he really does believe what he's spewing, man, he's wrong. I mean, dude is not only wrong, it's just sad. It's pathetic. It makes him a truly horrible judge of talent. Actually, before he said that, if he believes that, he was already a truly horrible judge of talent. I mean, a guy like 45 must have better things to do with his time than be the ultimate troll. The only way that comment works is if he meant it literally. Like, Steph's not in the Hall. Literally. Steph's not in the Hall of Fame. Yet. I mean, if that's how he meant it, and that's what he's saying, that's like the dumbest joke ever. But if he means he hasn't done enough to get into the Hall of Fame, then that really is one of the dumbest takes ever. I mean, get that hot take or his own show already. Damn, old man. Damn, old man. You got some bleep twisted. What's next? What's next, 45? Are you going to tell me that Space Jam wasn't my movie and that it was actually your movie?
I saw part of the movie, Mike, and I just want to thank you for co-starring in my movie with me.
That's what I heard. I co-starred with you. And thanks for doing that. That was nice of you.
You're welcome, Mike. You're welcome. That was nice of me, wasn't it? That was awfully big of me to let you in my movie. In the meantime, what did I just do? I rolled out the top of hour number two and I had to actually discuss this. So, Mike, now you owe me. I mean, you already owe me because I let you in my movie. But now you owe me again. You owe me because I let you in my movie. And now you owe me a segment because that was a colossal waste of time. So I think you got to make this right with me. Either come in here and let's do 10 minutes or start bumping up my Space Jam royalty checks from 11 cents to a quarter. Come to think of it, I'm sure it kills you that I make a literal dime off that flick every time it airs. Like, I probably don't deserve that, right? Freaking MJ. Arguably the greatest baller of all time, inarguably the worst talent evaluator of all time.
The ceiling is the roof.
And he was that even before that statement. John Morosi. John, so good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, I am outstanding, my friend. A happy game one of the World Series day to you, my friend.
Today, you too, John. Today is a really good day. So we're less than 12 hours away from the start of game one. But if you could, John, take me back to Saturday night. What were you thinking when the Yankees tied game six in the top of the ninth?
I thought at that point in time, Jim, that we were going to head to extra innings and obviously probably a game seven based on the way things had gone there and the big momentum shift. But I had forgotten about number 27 there for the Houston Astros and the fact that he may come to the plate in the bottom of the ninth, because he is a special player. And we saw, I think as well in his interview with Ken Rosenthal after the game, how incredibly humble he is. And I say this as someone who is basically his height. And I've had the honor of interviewing him after games in the playoffs the last number of years. And as I look at him in the eye after a game, and he's done something incredibly heroic to help his team win, and I just think to myself that one of the best two or three players in the world is my size. And it really is remarkable to say that. And he, but he does it with tremendous talent, belief, drive. Of course, he signed for under $20,000 his first pro contract out of Venezuela. Really wasn't supposed to even have the opportunity then, but he willed his way into convincing the Astros to give him a chance, and he has made himself into the player that he is today. I think his talent, the great thing about baseball, Jim, is it all comes in different shapes and sizes, and with Altuve, the power he possesses, the body control, the coordination, the lower body strength, and the hands and wrists, it's incredible. And he went through a tough time this year, Jim. He had an injury with his leg that really affected his ability to load properly on his back knee and get that spring that you see from his swing all the time. He's got it back now, and man, does he have a sense and a flair for the dramatic. I love watching him play.
John Morosi is joining us. Well said, John. One more thought about that. When you talk about Altuve, we're talking about a guy who is in a clubhouse full of MVP winners, MVP candidates, future Hall of Famers, yet every single guy there points to him as the heart and soul of that team. What do you make of that, and what's that say about Altuve?
Well, that's an excellent point, Jim, and you're right. He is, in many ways, the conscience of that team, and the conscience in some ways of Major League Baseball. He really has that integrity, and I thought, again, you the reason why he's so beloved and so revered, you know, Ken Rosenthal talking to him after the game on Saturday, he asked some more questions about his approach, and he just immediately started talking about Yuli Gurriel's home run and the catch by Brantley and Springer drawing a walk. He's the ultimate teammate, and he practices the finer things that help his team win games. I've always thought that watching the Astros play big games in recent years, it seems like Carlos Correa and Jose Altuve have more fun turning double plays the bigger the moment. They don't feel pressure. They feel excitement at being able to equal what's going on around them and deliver for their team. So he talks about wanting to perform not for himself but for his teammates. I get goosebumps just thinking about it and talking about it, because he represents everything that's great about baseball. And the great part about it, too, is no matter what shape or size you are, you can look at him and see yourself. Because we all have that little bit of an underdog in us at different times. And you look at him and say, look what he's done with his talent and his career. Look at the player that he's made himself into. And when you watch him on a field, all things feel possible, no matter which team you're rooting for. And I think that's, there's magic in saying that, Jim, for fans of all ages and all shapes and sizes and all backgrounds to look at him and feel a great deal of optimism about all things that we can achieve in sports and even outside of sports as well.
He certainly is astonishing. Game one of the World Series tonight, John Morosi is with us to break it all down. John, then you have the Nationals, who look like they were going to get knocked out in the wild card game. Then they come back, they win that, they take care of the Dodgers, they sweep the Cardinals. How do you explain how they're even four wins away from the World Series title the way they are right now?
Jim, it's an excellent question, and it's really remarkable what they've done this season. I even go back a little further, but we had a game with them on MLB Network in the early part of May in Philadelphia, and the conversation then was, how many more days was Dave Martinez going to be their manager? Mm. It felt that imminent. They had just fired their pitching coach, and it seemed as though managerial change was almost inevitable, but they've got the best record in the game since the latter part of June, and you're right, it was two eighth-inning rallies against the Brewers in the wild card game, and then against the Dodgers in Game 5 with the incredible turn of events against Clayton Kershaw that has now vaulted them into this position. Howie Kendrick was so immense, and of course Soto and Rendon going to his hometown in Houston. You're going to hear a lot about that, I'm sure, tonight on MLB Network and on the broadcast of the game as well. So to me, there's a really special quality to this team. I don't think that we can necessarily say, well, it's because they no longer have Harper that they were able to achieve these things. I don't think it's totally fair to put it that way, but there's definitely a unified feel on this team, and it almost took them, Jim, talking about underdog and Altuve, it almost took them becoming an underdog for them to do away with all these expectations that have dogged them for a decade about how they were supposed to win and be this great team. It's almost as though the way they started the season allowed them to take a deep breath and shuffle off the expectations and then just play. And when they just play, they're a really great baseball team with a tremendous rotation. And I think it's very poignant, Jim, that in this year of the opener and the year of bullpenning, we talk so much about the Yankees building their staff out from the ninth inning forward as opposed to the first inning on. You see right now probably the best rotation in the American League against probably the best rotation in the National League going against each other in the World Series. And also, in this year of the strikeout, we've got two lineups that put the ball in play. How old-time baseball is this? Starting rotations, putting the ball in play. We're probably talking about the 97 World Series and not the 19 one, Jim, but I think a lot of those things still apply right now.
It is true. Two unbelievable starting rotations, and then that leads us to the matchup. John, before you go, I can't let you go without a prediction for the series. If you had to make a pick, who do you like and why?
To me, Jim, it's the Astros. I think while they have some bullpen issues too, the Nationals have, I think, a little bit more concern there in the latter part of the game, and they were able to manage the shorter series well, I think, in that case for Dave Martinez. But in the long series, to find a way to beat the Astros at-bats, top to bottom, are just too good. They grind at-bats better than any team the Nationals have seen in the National League playoffs so far. I believe the Astros win in five or six games. I think they're just right now a better team. They were one of the two super teams in the American League this year. They were better than the Yankees, the other one. They won the most games in the regular season. The Nationals have had this long layoff, which I've seen before be a real factor. I think only one of the last eight teams, according to MLB.com, Jim, that have swept an LCS have gone on to win the World Series. It really puts you at a disadvantage. So I think the Astros win this series in five or six games.
Really quickly, we are debuting a brand new segment in the jungle, What's Your Beef? So I'm asking you for your beefs. And as I also mentioned, some of you took it seriously and some of you went clone with it. Here's an example of some of the beefs. Let me start with your tweets. Liz in Fall City. Quote, I have a beef with hair signed Rit. Liz, what can he or anybody else do about their hair?
It's lit!
They lose their hair. There's not a hell of a lot you can do about that, Liz. And Mark Cleversaw tweets, I have a problem with Kawhi Leonard going to the whack-ass Clippers. Man, come on. You know you should have been a Laker. Hashtag, what's your beef? All right, that's not bad. That's not bad. I don't agree with that, but that's not bad. Personally, my feeling is, why did he go to, quote, the whack-ass Clippers? Because the whack-ass Clippers are a better organization. The whack-ass Clippers, to me, are a better team. Whack-ass Clippers, as much as I like Frank Vogel, have got a better coach in Doc Rivers. Better opportunity for him. And Mailman Casey tweets, Jim, my beef is with anyone with a full head of hair and any person over 5'5". Signed, Rick in Buffalo. Again. Two things that you have no control over, your hair and your height. Jamie in Green Bay tweets, my beef is with the tour stops ending. You're long overdue for a trip back to Green Bay. That's fair. That's good beef. Thomas tweets, my beef is NFL schedule makers who had the bright idea that the Pats v. Jets was a good primetime matchup. Okay. Okay. Let's go to some other beefs. These beefs are via email. Hey, Rome, what's my beef? My beef is with my parents. Who names their only child Mitch? Mitch from Buffalo debating a name change to Dirk. Again, you're beefing about things you've got no control over. Your name, your height, how much hair you have or don't. Rome, I've got a beef and a tank full of gravy to go with it. Mark Mangino. All right, so like 1,000 beef jokes. Rome, I've got a beef with one of the XR4TI members who doesn't eat any. I listen to your show. I slide my take into your inbox, and they get the hammer by a dude that wears capris, has no less than 6 vegan cookbooks, and he runs marathons. Having a sports take gets stonewalled by a guy who does not watch any grinds the gears, Romy. Having a sports take gets stonewalled by a guy who doesn't watch any grinds the gears. Yes, he wears capris. Yes, he runs marathons. Yes, he has vegan cookbooks, but he does watch sports. I told him when I hired him. It's part of the job. What's the beef? What's your beef? Let's go to the phones. I've already heard beefs on Twitter. Well, I've read beefs on Twitter. I've read beefs on email. Let's go to the phones and hear what they sound like. Scotty in New York. Scotty, what's going on?
Oh, my God, man. My beef is with my mother. I'm sitting there watching the game, and every time Indianapolis scores, it makes me want to puke. I want to go upside her freaking head with a bat. Oh, my gosh, man. And the ref. That's another beef I have. I can't believe the ref. What is in the grass or in the grass? Oh, my God, were they smoking grass before they came out on the field? What's up with that, Rome? I don't understand that crap. Football is so
Oh, I get it. Scotty. Scotty Farrell.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
No, you're not. No, you're not. I know Scotty Farrell. He's a legend in this business. An icon. This, Alvin, is Scotty Farrell.
I hope you're in your car listening to me right now, you fat ass. You are despicable because you just let that happen to your star quarterback. And don't tell me you know more than me because you're some head coach. You're an idiot. You're a moron. No one, I don't care who you are. No one does that to a star player in the NFL except you, you loser.
My beef is that you would come on my show, disrespect a man like that. Because only Scotty has got that in him. One and only Scotty Farrell. All right, let's try line number one in Richmond. It's part of our What's Your Beef segment. Trip in Richmond. Hey, Trip, how are you?
Hey, how are you, man?
Good.
Good, yeah. I got beef with the Patriots. I had their kicker. I started a FanDuel account, and I played a single game. And I just needed him to kick a field goal at the end, and they got down to like the 30-40-yard line twice in the fourth quarter and punted it away. And I ended up winning $2 when I could have won $100.
That does kind of suck, but you can't really put that on the kicker, right? That wasn't his decision to punt.
Well, yeah, it was more of the coaches. I expected more of the Patriots. They already beat a team over 40 this year. I expected a field goal wouldn't have hurt.
All right, Tripp, I feel you. I mean, I understand how that goes, except they had already beaten them into submission. And you have to understand that the hood, Bill Belichick, is not thinking to himself, man, my boy Tripp in Richmond has probably got money in a FanDuel contest and needs an extra kick here. Yeah, I don't know if I really want to insult the Jets. I've already beaten them into submission. I've already snatched their soul. I already made them quit. I've already embarrassed the hell out of them on national TV, but I bet somewhere someone stands to make $100 on a field goal. Hey, you know what? Screw it. Let's kick it. Listen, I do feel your pain. And the reason I feel your pain is because I do dabble. And because I do dabble, there have been games recently where a guy had a clear walk into the end zone, no names mentioned, and took a knee and did the right thing. The right thing for him, the right thing for his team, the right thing for the universe, really, because karma's a bitch and it will come back and bite, but it was not the right thing for me. So I know what you're talking about. Going to any sports book. Going to any sports book and watch games and see the reaction at the end of games that have long since been decided. That's always been one of my favorite things to do. Long before there was even an easing of regulation and gaming became more and more of a prominent thing. One of my favorite things was not just to go to a sports book and get down, but to go to a sports book and hang around till the end of the game when it was long since decided and hear the reaction on a play that was made or not made. This says, this may sound crazy, but my beef is with Jim Rome. Two of the funniest segments in history have been removed from the show. I know we're trying to make this sports talk show better, but laughing is good for my health. Bring back self glass Friday.
He glassed me.
And the hack off. Son, Robert Brown. Hey, Bobby. I respect that you went like all government with it and signed it Robert Brown. Bro, if I were you, no offense, you probably want to go middle initial. There's got to be a lot of Robert Browns out there. Robert Brown. Anyway, he wants me to bring back the hack off. If I could justify it, I would, Bob. Remember, this thing died. I had to end it in the middle of it once. It was that bad. In terms of self-glass Friday,
he glassed me.
You mean when people glass themselves?
He glassed me.
Those rare Fridays where dudes were glassing themselves?
He glassed me.
The self-glass Friday. All right, I'll wear that. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I killed the hack off, and I killed self-glass Friday.
He glassed me.
I just got tired of people glassing themselves.
He glassed me.
Yo, Jimmer, my beef? Four-way stops. People roll to the stop sign at the same time. They stop and they stare at each other. Then everybody goes at once. The car to the right has the right of way. Kevin, in Newark, in NorCal. Nice job, Kevin. Good job, Kevin. That's good. That's good. I like that. Yeah, but you got to admit, it's pretty funny though, right? Everybody stops, they all stare, and then everybody at the same time goes, screw it, I'll go. And then they all slam into each other. He's right. The one on the right does have right of way, right? Hey, Jimmy, my beef is with the Whistler guy at work. Shut the hell up. Work is not that fun. It's a construction site, dork. Take your soft ass somewhere else. Damn. Thanks, Jim. I feel much better now. I almost wanted to throw my hammer towards his head. Thanks for keeping me out of jail for attempted murder. Scott from Sacktown. The thing is, this segment is working really well. I just want to make sure it's not a one-off. Like, I don't want you all to run out of your beefs. Anybody else? 1-800-636-8686. Let's go, Green Bay. David in Green Bay. Good to have you, David. What's your beef?
I've got beef with the Green Bay or the Wisconsin Badgers defense. Illinois. What? Half a star recruit running back, maybe? And now you're supposed to go stop J.K. Dobbins at Ohio State? Yeah. What leader? What running back?
That's not a good call. Alvin, no. How come?
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
My man was a little bit upset. I am a little bit close to it because I was in Madison over the weekend. My son goes to Madison. I'm a little bit close to it, so maybe I gave him a little more leeway. He was upset, man. And I understand why he was upset. They're up 23-14. They were not having their best day, but a good enough day. Finish. Choke the Illini out. Get the hell out of there. Live to get ready for the next war. But it didn't happen.
What leader?
My man was still that upset on Tuesday. I don't know which leader he was trying to take a run at. Jonathan Taylor? Paul Christ? I don't know.
What leader? What running back?
What quarterback? What defense? I don't know. How about what opponent? Illinois earned that game. They deserve that game. They outplayed, outhearted, out-executed. And it's the lamest cliche ever, but they just wanted it worse. They played with a greater sense of urgency. And my feeling is, Wisconsin went out of their way to say, we will not overlook them. This is not a trap game. But they seemed to overlook them, right? They did not play with the same sense of urgency. They just didn't. Let's go to Kentucky. Wrapping up our first ever What's Your Beef segment. Steve in Kentucky. Hey, Steve, how are you?
What's up, Jimbo?
What's up, man? How are you?
Great. Hey, I just got a problem with that old Conor McGregor. He promotes that Irish whiskey, number 12, preferred number 12. That's how old you got to be to drink it. It won't even get a fly high. It's 80 proof. The girls at the bingo hall won't even drink it. It's no good. He runs around punching old men. I'm an old man. If he comes gets me, I'll do a shot of Wild Turkey and light him up. If he ever wants to meet me on the Jim Rome show and go shot for shot, we'll do it. And I've been on this show before. Self Gloss Day, it's the Cobra out.
You gotta run him, man. Cobra! I liked it. I was gonna run it. I was gonna rack him too. Not a very good call. You just heard the guy. Cobra. We don't self glass.
He glassed me!
He glassed himself the Cobra. Listen, next time, that went pretty well. The What's Your Beef segment, we'll bring that back on Thursday. The next time you want a protein snack, ditch the drinks and the bars and grab a bag of Old Trapper beef jerky. Tender, tasty real beef that rocks your craving for a snack that satisfies. Ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? All right, we'll run that back on Thursday of next week, so keep it in mind. If you have a beef, save it till then. If you have a take, I'll take it right now. Ben Golliver is my guest. Ben, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. I've just been pummeled by this NBA in China story for like the last 2 weeks, and I took a clean shot to the face with the Zion Williamson injury news. So it's a very strange start to the NBA season, I think, for basketball diehards and probably for the league itself too.
I think you're right. Ben, let me ask you about the latter as opposed to the former. This was supposed to be the most exciting day of the year because the NBA season was starting, and as you mentioned, Zion was going to open up against the Raptors. Then all the air came out of the balloon with the news of his knee injury and ensuing surgery. Before we get into the timelines, the point that you just made, I mean, you've said that you treat Zion like your, quote, very large adult son. It's a great line. Emotionally, how are you holding up?
Oh, I'm doing okay, Jim. You know, I can't wait to see you back. I'm glad it was only 6 to 8 weeks. It's just meniscus. You know, it's not an ACL or something that's going to really, you know, change the course of his career. But we can't wait to see this guy on the court, Jim. And, you know how gravy trains work. This is one of the ultimate gravy trains in NBA history. They had him on for ring night Tuesday night against the Toronto Raptors. They had him on ESPN Friday night against Luka Doncic and the Dallas Mavericks. They had 5 of his first 7 games nationally televised. He is projected to miss about 20 games. 11 of those games for the New Orleans Pelicans were going to be on national television, and everybody's just hoping that he can get back for that Christmas Day game because, of course, that's going to be a major rating bonanza for the NBA too. So this is a situation where all the major television executives, the television partners, whether it's Turner and ESPN, NBA TV, they were all lined up to just kind of like roll out the red carpet for Zion Williamson. And unfortunately, this knee injury is kind of dashing all of their plans.
Ben Golliver joining us. You know, Ben, when you watched him in the preseason and you saw the way he was showing up in terms of scoring and passing, what kind of thoughts did you have? I mean, should that have answered any questions that anybody would have had about how his game was going to translate to the NBA?
No, he's a stud, Jim. I mean, come on. Like, we're looking around at some of the best young players right now, and a lot of them are foreign players. I mean, Nikola Jokic, Giannis Antetokounmpo. I mean, you go right down the list, Ben Simmons. A lot of these guys are hailing from different countries. To me, what's so important about Zion is that he's probably the brightest American prospect that there is out there right now. I mean, you look at USA basketball struggling through that World Cup in China last month. I'll tell you one guy who would have changed the whole course of that team on the court and just from a buzz standpoint, a hype standpoint, that would have been Zion Williamson. And I would love to see him next summer on an Olympic team. I mean, can you imagine an Olympic team going to Tokyo, say with LeBron, Zion, Steph Curry, Damian Lillard. I mean, that's going to have a lot of people watching. That's kind of the dream scenario. So to me, what we saw in the preseason was very efficient scoring, him going right at NBA caliber centers, taking it right into their chest, no problem finishing around them. Lots of, you know, team first hustle plays, and then also an unselfish passing attitude. I love that he doesn't get so overly locked in on just dunking and trying to score the ball every time. He makes the right play. They're setting him up for success in New Orleans. I just can't wait to see this guy back on the court.
Ben Golliver is joining us once again. All right, Ben, so on top of the Zion news, you have Steve Kerr telling NBC Sports Bay Area that it's, quote, unlikely that Klay Thompson is going to play this season. What's your reaction when you hear that news?
Well, I think that's actually welcome news, to be honest. I think it takes the pressure off Klay Thompson sort of either way. And I think in general, after you get burned with that Kevin Durant situation during the finals last year, you should be erring on the side of caution. And I, by the way, I feel the same way about the Kevin Durant situation. There's already these rumbles coming out of Brooklyn. Oh, he's going to try to come back during this season from an Achilles injury. I really hope not. I don't want to see Kevin Durant or Klay Thompson on a basketball court until next year. Of course, that pains me to say it. I mean, those are two of, all-star level guys every single year, two champions, you know, two basketball warriors. But sometimes health comes first. Both those guys are coming off of major injury situations. And to be honest, I'm not sure either the Warriors or the Nets are really in position to compete for a title this season. And so from that standpoint, what's the rush? Just go ahead and take the slow approach, play for next season.
Ben Golliver is joining us. All right, so the Warriors might not be, but what about the teams in Los Angeles? You got a doubleheader tonight, Ben, and the battle for Los Angeles is the second game there. I mean, I understand there are 81 games to come after this, so there's no reason to read too much into this one game, especially since the Clippers are not at full health. But what are you looking to see from both of these teams tonight?
Well, first of all, they said there's like 450 media credentials for the game tonight, so it's going to be like sardines in the locker room. That's probably more for one game than the Clippers had for an entire season like 10 years ago, if you think about it. But how times have changed. From the Clippers, I want to see where Kawhi Leonard's body is at and how many minutes he plays out of the gate. You know, he told people during the preseason, it kind of went under the radar, but he didn't play any 5-on-5 basketball all summer long. I mean, he was really kind of, you know, limiting what his workouts were. And so we just need to see how does he hold up under big minutes. For the Lakers, it's all about just oohing and aahing at these pick and rolls from LeBron James and Anthony Davis. The Lakers fans have already seen it a couple times during the preseason where when those two guys are working the two-man game, Anthony Davis is cutting down the middle of the paint. Defenders have no idea how to handle these two guys because of LeBron's passing ability and Davis's incredible finishing ability. So I think it's going to be an exciting opener. LeBron's already tweeting about how he feels like it's the night before Christmas yesterday. And I think a lot of Lakers fans who are looking at trying to get back into the playoffs, you know, for the first time in a long time, they're feeling pretty excited about this group.
We're talking to Ben Golliver for a few more moments. Ben, what about Utah? They've been a fashionable dark horse in previous seasons. But when you look at the moves that they made in the offseason, are they still that? Are they a dark horse or are they a legitimate contender now?
I think they've got to be in that top class of contenders. I put them and Denver. You know, it's just one of those things where, like, those small market teams are always going to get overlooked in favor of the glitzier teams in Los Angeles, or even like the Warriors in past years being in the Bay Area. But both Utah and Denver, super deep, balanced. They can score the basketball. They can shoot the basketball. And then defensively, they know who they want to be. And I think both those teams deserve to be kind of up near the top. But the Jazz have just done everything the right way. It's been sort of a deliberate building process. They realized that Rudy Gobert was going to be the captain of an excellent defense a few years ago, and they just have methodically brought in the pieces around him to sort of make it work. They just, you know, re-upped Coach Quinn Snyder, who's done an awesome job, is probably a Coach of the Year candidate this year, to a new contract as well. They've got all their ducks in a row. I don't see any drama from that group. I see a lot of veterans who want to get over the hump, whether it's a Mike Conley, a Bogdanovich, who struggled in last year's playoffs, Rudy Gobert, of course, who's trying to have his breakthrough moment. And then they've got that young star in the making in Donovan Mitchell, who just kind of adds an element of pop and excitement to the whole thing. They're absolutely a team to watch this year. They've kind of been a darling of the basketball dorks these last couple of years. I think it's a different story this year. I just think they're really, really good.
Ben, one thought before you go. What about the East? Is the East a two-horse race between Philadelphia and Milwaukee, or can you make a case for somebody other than those two who has a legitimate look at it?
So to me, those are the top two teams, clearly, not even really that close. I think with Milwaukee, the offense is going to be as devastating as it was last year. Giannis is going to be right back in that MVP conversation. He looked out of control good during their preseason run. And then with Philly, you know, they've got a few things to shake out. They're going to have to find the shooting. They're going to have to find the right lineups and build the chemistry with their new pieces. But they're just big, strong, tough. They're going to pound a lot of teams. Embiid could be in that MVP conversation as well. And so to me, those are easily the top two teams. Now, if there is a surprise team out there, though, I think it could be the Toronto Raptors. I think everybody's sleeping on them a little bit just because you lose Kawhi Leonard and, you know, all the expectations change when you lose your finals MVP and your franchise guy. They still have an all-star point guard in Kyle Lowry. Pascal Siakam, to me, is going to make his first all-star game this year. They've got multiple, you know, experienced, tested, proven interior defenders with Marcus Gasol, Serge Ibaka, and they've got some pretty good depth and a creative coach in Nick Nurse as well. I mean, that's a pretty good package, you know. So if one of those two teams, whether it's Philly or Milwaukee, slips up or gets injuries or winds up not living up to expectations, I actually think it's the defending champion Toronto Raptors who are poised to sneak into that Eastern Conference Finals.
He's in midseason form already. National NBA writer for the Washington Post, co-host of the Open Floor podcast, and again, good friend of the program, Ben Golliver. Ben, great job. Thank you so much. Always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you too, Jim. Take care, man.
What's going on, Jeff? How are you?
Thanks for the fine, Jim. Hey, Clones, did you see Ira Craig's tweet that he got his first royalty check for his book and spent all of it at 7-Eleven on some pink champagne? That's right, ladies. Ira doesn't just have 7-Eleven money. He has the only court champagne they sell at 7-Eleven money. Yes, while other aspiring writers just dream about the day when they can spend their royalty checks at 7-Eleven, Ira lives it. Jim, I want to congratulate Ira, but I can't because self-publishing is not an accomplishment. It's an admission of defeat. So instead, let me say my condolences to you, Ira, for the death of any hope that a real publisher would ever invest in your manuscript. What Ira doesn't realize is that the manuscript titled When Every Day is Friday Night has been written and submitted by every wannabe rock star who's ever worked more than 12 months at Guitar Center. The difference between those dudes and Ira is the dudes from Guitar Center's dream is to be rock stars, while Ira's dream is to work at Guitar Center. Hey, Ira, here's what those publishing houses tell all those Guitar Center dudes. Yeah, every day of your life might be Friday night, but when your Friday nights are nothing but strippers and fat chicks, you're not interesting. In fact, there's a running joke amongst publishing house workers that they're all going to write a book titled When Every Day is Reading, Yet Another Lame Version of When Every Day is Friday Night. On the plus side, Ira can always use his unsold copies to build himself an igloo-style structure to sleep in and have plenty of extra copies left over to start a barrel fire. Just saying.
Good night now!